Find your missing ingredient at the 2024 National Restaurant Show. Whether you're looking to adapt your offerings to satisfy shifting dinner expectations, seamlessly navigate razor-thin margins, or integrate next-era solutions to offset labor challenges, the show has everything you need to plate up success for your operation. See tomorrow's ideas come to life and find inspiration for your next big concept as you explore a bustling show floor featuring over 900 product categories. From award-winning food and beverage items to innovative back-of-house equipment and technology. Join your peers at the show for Food Service in Chicago, May 18th to 21st, and get a taste of the future. Visit the official show website at www.nationalrestaurantshow.com to register and learn more.
Welcome to Menu Feed, a weekly podcast from Restaurant Business and Food Service Director. I'm Pat Kobe, Senior Menu Editor covering both brands. Joining me on the podcast is John Mannion, chef owner of El Che Steakhouse and Bar and the New Brasero, both in Chicago. John spent some of his childhood in Brazil and developed lasting taste memories for South American food and ingredients. At his first Chicago restaurant, La Serena Clandestina, he recreated some of those favorites, but the space, now closed, was too small to fully explore the depth of Brazilian cuisine. Brasero is a tribute to those flavors and culinary experiences, with a menu featuring live-fire grilled seafood and meats and slow-cooked over charcoal marinated chicken. The chef is also offering his take on feijoada, personalizing Brazil's national dish with elements like a smoked and braised beef shank, fermented collard green kimchi, and orange mostarda. Listen as John talks about how he revolutionized live-fire cooking at El Che, gives the lowdown on Brasero's unique wine program and menu, and shares how he blends a bit of the Midwest into all his restaurants. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, I read a little bit about your culinary journey, but can you tell me about it in your own words, you know, how you started and how you ended up in Chicago?
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I think that this really kind of starts when I was a wee lad. You know, when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, my dad came to our little kitchen table in suburban Detroit and said, hey, how would you kids feel about moving to São Paulo, Brazil? And being, as I remember it, pretty unsophisticated. I didn't really know where that was. So I think that my sister and I agreed that we thought that would be a capital idea. So the way I remember it is the next day they were loading up our toys. And, you know, a couple of days later, we were in the middle of São Paulo, which was, you know, big, like you can't imagine. And all the things that were comforting to me were not there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it really served as this awakening. I was very fortunate. We got to travel all over South America when I was a little kid, and my mind was blown. You know, what I found out pretty quickly is that one, the things that as a youngster I turned my nose up to were actually delicious and worth exploring. Two, being an expat, being really insular with our family, you know, like moving around São Paulo, we spent a lot of time with each other. The table was central to our experience, you know, whether it be with other families, with new friends. We were always around a dinner table or, you know, in an asado in a backyard, or we were constantly eating, constantly around food. And it became this really pivotal moment in my life. Mm. So we moved back to the States when I was a young teen, and all those things were kind of gone, you know. We moved to 80s, gray suburban Detroit, where all these, you know, these culinary events, as my dad used to say, the party's over.
Yeah, Detroit is like a lot different now, but back then it was very middle America, I imagine.
It was very middle America. But you know, it's, you know, one funny thing to take away from that was it being Detroit. I thought, and this is kind of tells you a lot about how, what a huge melting pot and how vast Brazil is, I thought Lebanese food was Brazilian food because it's just something that, you know, is in the culinary vernacular of what you eat in São Paulo, especially, you know, in a casual sense. So I was kind of shocked to discover that, in fact, it was not from Brazil. It was from a whole different part of the world.
Yeah.
But my interest was piqued. And we, you know, I when I got jobs in my young teens, I worked in restaurants. I was absolutely in love with cooking. My mom was a great cook and was of the, you know, Jacques Pepin and Julia Child ilk of the 70s, 80s. Right. So, you know, I just remember her burning veal bones and what that smelled like. But so we were always around food. You know, when I was younger and going to high school and college, I don't know that becoming a chef was anything anybody was really trying to do. It certainly wasn't a sexy kind of like, you know, what it is today. Mm-hmm. But I had the sense that I wanted to be in the restaurant business all throughout college. You know, I worked in restaurants. When I moved out to D.C., when I graduated with, I graduated from Marquette University with double major in English and political science, which left me uniquely unqualified to really do much of anything except move to D.C.,
right,
which is full of people who are uniquely unqualified to do a whole lot of anything. So other than read and write. So I got a job, you know, first at an issues-based PR firm, which is as dreadful as it sounds. But then, you know, I also worked in restaurants. Mm. So shout out Hard Times Cafe. At some point, you know, my dad sat me down and said, what are you going to do with your life, man? And I decided that being from the Midwest, I'd move back to Chicago where I'd moved to Chicago, mm-hmm. where most of my college friends lived, which made it easy, and start this career in the culinary arts. I thought it was my easiest way. Easy is the wrong term. It was my path to restaurant ownership, which was the ultimate goal. That said, you know, when I was starting out, knowing nothing and really getting my ass handed to me, my goal was always to kind of explore these South American flavors that were, you know, so pivotal to how I approached food, how I thought about food. You know, pre-internet. Free, you know, you had to go find books. You had to there wasn't Brazilian food in Chicago. So you'd have to go to New York or Miami and, you know, chase these flavors down.
Right.
And I did that in my mid to late 20s at a place called Moss on Division Street in Wicker Park, when Wicker Park was really in its cultural boom. You know, it was the end of the indie rock explosion, it was the beginning of a long gentrification. And this area was really blowing up and really excited to be in. Mm-hmm. You know, during the course of Cooking Moss, which was about 9 years, I ended up going to Argentina quite a bit. You know, first, there was a young woman who was from Buenos Aires, who I went down to visit with. And I just fell in love with the idea. Well, not the idea, the practice of asado. And I was fascinated by cooking over embers. You know, I had been exposed to it as a kiddo in São Paulo. You know, churrasco is certainly a big part of it. And I distinctly remember one of the first things I remember is the smell of picanha just dripping over charcoal. Like, to me, that's just an intoxicating aroma. But so I decided that when I did my first place, it would be a Midwestern version of a classic Argentine parrillada. And that's what El Che is. It took me forever to get it open. You know, this was like early 2000s. We opened in 2016, but that's kind of what I fell in love with.
Did you ever go to culinary school?
I did. When I moved to Chicago, I went to Kendall College I got a certificate for about 6 months.
Cool.
And I worked full time and I went to school full time. You know, the thing of it was that I had already been to college. So being in class with a bunch of 18-year-olds was not necessarily for me. And, you know, I think that a lot of people have, other than maybe the people who go to CIA, have this experience where there's three or four people in a class of 30 who are pretty serious about it. And everyone else is kind of trying to figure it out. So I was definitely in that. I worked full time. I was in this mode of, you need to get out of my way.
Yeah.
and I ended up, I was just learning so much more working than I was in school that it didn't make a lot of sense to continue on.
Definitely, yeah. Now, you opened La Serena Clandestina first before El Che.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. That was the accidental restaurant. So what happened there was we, after Moss closed in the beginning, like 2008, you know, that whole unpleasantness, I had plans to do El Che. I had investors lined up to do El Che, and then 2008 happened.
Oh.
And, you know, wah-wah.
Yeah.
That kind of went away. So I went out and I worked. I did a ton of consulting. I took various jobs, but the plan was always to do El Che. I met my current business partner back then, and he had been in commercial real estate, and he was kind of very interested in the business side of the restaurant business. So we decided to do this together. His name's Daniel Boyd. And we did a pop-up on Fulton Market back when it was just like the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It was literally the meatpacking at a place called Dodo. Kim, who was a friend of mine, who I'd known for a long time, had this little, breakfast lunch shop.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a pop-up there, and it was very successful. And it turns out she was not going to make it, and she was going to lose her lease. So we decided to team up, and the name of the pop-up was La Serena Clandestina, because it was Nelche food. It was kind of like this beachy Brazilian vibe food. And, you know, it's the stuff I'm kind of exploring now.
Right.
That I fell in love with when I was a kid. The place was just kind of a bit of a dump. So it felt like this, like, just really ramshackle beach shack. And we did that. It went great. And decided to take over the lease and do La Serena there.
Mm-hmm.
And then continue looking for LJ.
Got it.
So, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, I forgot about La Serena. How can I forget
about La Serena? What does La Serena Clandestina translate as?
The Hidden Mermaid.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I always need stories, you know, like for anything that I do, I need a bit of a backstory. And it's usually just for myself, but I share it with key people and it'll become a design touchstone. But La Serena Clandestina was like, I was kind of obsessed with this time. It's now kind of booming, but there's this place outside of Rio called Búzios.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this beach town. There's a bunch of different like bahias, like bays. And it's just like super cool, super laid back. It's the beaches are beautiful. And it's far enough away from Rio that you get the sense you're really far away.
Mm-hmm.
So this got put on the map, and I think it was 1964. Brigitte Bardot went there with her then Brazilian boyfriend. There's photos of it, and it was like this whole thing. And now there's a film festival in Búzios every year. And the cinema is like dedicated to Brigitte Bardot. But I became like real obsessed with this beginning of the jet set of Bossa Nova, of Bardot on the beach. And that was kind of like the marching orders for La Serena Clandestina. So La Serena was definitely Bardot, and then Clandestina because it was kind of a, you know, on the down low event.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mouthful. It was a great name for a pop-up, but then it didn't seem right to change it for a restaurant, so he just kept it.
Cool. And did you have to educate like diners about what you were doing? Because, you know, I know there are a lot of Mexican restaurants in Chicago, probably more than any other city, maybe except LA. But
Chicago,
yeah, I'm not sure they knew about Argentina.
No one knows anything about it. You know, I think that most people think that Brazilian food is either there's the segment of North Americans who think that everything below Texas is Mexican food. And that's true. That's a true statement.
Right.
There's also a lot of people who think that Brazilian food is just fogo de chão. And I think that at Serena, I did take on sort of an educational role there. But, you know, for what I'm doing now at Bracero, it's just food. Okay. So, like, I stay away from the Brazil of it all.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it is, like, obviously what we're doing. These are memories. These are things I grew up with. It's one of many things that influenced how I cook and how I think about the world. So to an extent, it's just kind of like the beginning, you know, it's just gotta be delicious is where we start.
Mm-hmm.
And the sandbox we're playing in are these South American flavors, but it's not traditional. And I just want it to be delicious. And I want this leitmotif, this through line to go through what we do here. So it's not a chaos menu. It all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like letting people know, educating people, it's the vibe.
Right.
That was a long answer to it.
No, that's a great answer. And Brazil just opened in like the beginning of February. So
3 weeks ago yesterday.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. It's great that you're even here to talk to me. But as far as the menu goes, can you tell me a little bit about it? I know it has, you know, some the feijoada is like the national dish of Brazil, and that's not found everywhere in the U.S. Probably not anywhere else in Chicago, I would imagine. But
no, I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, there's little joints that do feijoada here and there, but you know, there are some kind of classic things here. You know, we have pão de queijo, we have like a coxinha. It's not like it isn't usually coxinhas made with chicken. This is made with duck, and it's not very traditional. Mm-hmm. The moqueca is a through line for me from a culinary standpoint, going back to Mas. So going back almost, I don't know, since 98, I've always done a version of it. It hasn't really varied that much. I did it at Mas. I've done it at various places. I think it's one of the, you know, the world's great dishes. The feijoada is not, it is a way of serving this huge beef shank that we have mm-hmm. as a communal meal, but it isn't, you know, necessarily traditional. And we've taken some of the sides and turned them on their ear a little bit. You know, instead of just orange slices, we have a preserved orange marmalade from Mostarda. You know, instead of just straight up collard greens, we have we fermented it and made it into almost a kimchi. So there's, you know, it has elements, but it's not necessarily straight down the middle.
Right. And I also read that you'd put like a Midwestern touch on some things, you know, like you bring in some of the Midwest into your cooking. So how do you?
For sure. That's like, that's who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that really is, here's the thing. We live here. I have relationships with farmers and producers here. So mm-hmm. that's going to be the first thing we look at. It is what's seasonal, what's delicious, who do we have relationships with before we go chasing down, you know, the exotica. Mm-hmm. So you could say like the Indiana chickens that were grilling over charcoal in a manner that you might see at like Boteca in Rio de Janeiro. Like it's all about the chicken. My chicken's from here. The method may be, you know, the method is definitively South American, but what's on the plate, it's from here.
And when you opened El Che, did you have to put in special equipment to do the style cooking that you wanted?
Oh,
you
know, like the wood charcoal? So we put in a huge fan. The hearth is completely custom made. It is a friend of mine, Bobby Middleton, who is, you know, first a motorcycle producer and mechanic. You know, he's very big in the custom bike world, custom Harley world. He has a metal shop. He's a friend. We started talking about one thing, and I just did drawings of like what I wanted to do, and he was like, "Man, I'm making this. I'm doing this." So he built most of what's in the hearth there. There's a grill that comes from a guy in Texas, NorCal Ovenworks. But for the most part, like that was all kind of our just, will this or won't it work? We were still kind of pioneers in that. I certainly learned a lot about thermodynamics the hard way.
Yeah. Well, you got all your inspections passed, so you must have been doing something right.
Yeah, we did. Trust me, when the fire inspection was done, I was like, actually passed us? What?
Do you have anything special in Brasera that, you know, any kind of special equipment there?
Oh, yeah, we do. We have a 9-foot custom-built hearth by Gary in Texas that is unique in its design. It has two sort of Argentine grills flanking a central wood-burning oven that can also serve as a smoker during the day, can convert from a big grill into a smoker. That was something we kind of worked on together. Again, I am not a engineer, so a lot of like just kind of scribbles. But and when that got delivered, I had to take out the front of the restaurant to get it in.
Wow.
And trust me, I had many sleepless nights hoping that it worked the way that I hoped that it would. And it does. It works great.
Great. And what do you cook on there? You mentioned the chickens, but...
The chickens, the ribs, we'll finish some steaks on it. You know, most things kind of go from one zone to another. So if you want something to get a little bit of smoke, it'll start up high on that grill and finish one of the other grills. But yeah, and then during the day, we'll smoke the beef shanks in there and get them started along braise. A lot of the production gets done there.
And so The wine list is very unique too, because you have a lot of South American wines, or maybe all South American, or they.
Yeah, we have all South American wines. When we came back from the pandemic at Che, you know, when we opened Che in 2016, I had this inkling that I really wanted to do an all South American wine list. Having just come back from Argentina, there seemed to be this just revolution going on down there of these younger winemakers who were starting smaller vineyards, but also younger winemakers in larger families like Sebastian Zuccardi, who were revolutionizing the way that Argentine wines were made and considered, and came back to the States. It just didn't seem like there was enough here in Chicago to do a whole wine list. So flash forward a couple of years, and you know, during the pandemic, we sold meat, we sold wine. And then when we came back, we were going to open, we didn't have a whole lot in the cellar. We had sold through almost anything to the point where we were ordering things just to sell to our customers. And so me and Alex Cooper, our wine director, started talking about, you know, what we wanted this to look like and what direction we're going to go in. And so we started tasting wines. And one day he called me over, and there was this Bernardo from Mendoza. He goes, "You got to taste this." And it was that aha moment of, we can do this. And I told him, I'm like, "Alex, this is what we're doing, 100%. We are doing a South American wine list entirely. The first caveat was, you know, champagne is champagne. But then, so we had to have some champagne. But then we tasted a couple sparklings from Brazil, and I was like, you know what? No, let's go all in. We're 100% in on this. So we have, to my knowledge, that I can find, and I've looked, the largest selection of South American wines in North America. Both lists are 100% South American. You know, the Che list grows weekly in terms of verticals. It's special. By going all in, we have been able to, we have a lot of great relationships in Chile and Argentina, where the doors have opened for us. We can get a lot of things that no one else can. There's a lot of small production things that we just buy all of. And then the approach to the wine list here at Bracero, and this is 100% an Alex Cooper innovation. You want to do something different. A lot of the kind of, I don't know, more natural, low intervention, higher acidity, what you might call fun wines that maybe we have a lot of them that maybe work better at, we love them at Che, but they don't necessarily work with what we're doing as well as some other things. So we wanted them over here. We brought on a lot more, and we have at Bracero 100 bottle wine list they're all under $100.
Wow. That's amazing.
It's pretty amazing. There's also if you want to drop some coin, there is a small reserve list that you know, Alex Cooper's picks, but yeah, and it's been, we're selling a ton of wine here. It's great because, you know, we do have steaks and pork chops and things like that here, but he and I have been in steak business for many years now, and we treat Malbec at Che like a lot of American steakhouses would treat Cabernet Sauvignon, which the list is large and exhaustive and getting bigger, and we're taking on as much as we can and looking for bottles here. The food's bolder and brasher and spicier, and it lends itself to a lot of the lower intervention, just interesting wines.
I know, a lot of the Chilean whites are very reasonably priced, so you must have wide range of prices up to $100.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a magnum of Roberto Enriquez here that's white that is under $100. And it's if I were dining here, I'd take two.
And how about the cocktails? Are they kind of Latin inspired as well?
Yeah. The traditions in Brazil are definitely, the caipirinha is one of the world's greatest drinks.
Yeah, I love caipirinhas. They're really hard to find here, and lots of bars don't even know how to make them. But
a lot of people don't know how to make them. The thing with the caipirinha is it's kind of a little nasty drink. You know, it's best consumed on the beach. You want to have that little grit of the sugar. Cachaça, you know, I appreciate high end aged cachaça, but for me, I like the stuff that kind of tastes like petrol. And then cut that with lime, and it's a beautiful thing. But yeah, we're definitely cocktail forward here at Bracero. Doug Phillips is heading up the list here, and it's been super duper fun. Again, you know, really based on Latin American spirits.
Mm-hmm. Do you do piscos too? Pisco sours?
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
I definitely have to check it out. It sounds like you have all my favorite things.
The pisco sour is something we have at, I've had kind of at every restaurant that I've done.
Thanks so much, John. Can't wait to stop by Brasero on my next visit to Chicago. You can download this episode of Menu Feed and past episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Pat Covey.
But we're definitely out there championing the beauty of a well-made pisco sour.
Well, I haven't been in Brasero yet, obviously, because it just opened, but I have been in your other two restaurants. And it seems like all of them have a very casual, welcoming vibe. I mean, that's what makes them special, too, because even though the food is fine dining and chef driven, it's kind of a casual ambiance. Is that something you intend to do?
Approachable, for sure. Yeah. For us, you know, I think that call it special sauce, call it competitive advantage. But like what the main thing that we're trying to provide here is an experience. You know, oftentimes when you dine out, it's not necessarily, let's assume that if you're going to open a restaurant, you can cook some food and it's going to be good. But it's how a restaurant makes you feel is important to me. So that's the music, it's the lighting, but more than anything, it's the service.